You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
As a writer in Myanmar, our creativity never because of the freedom we have. Our creativity is more or less resting on the hunting for the freedom we want to have.
Welcome back to the Wheeler Centre podcast. The following event was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their elders past and present as the custodians of the world's oldest living culture. In this episode, renowned Burmese human rights activist, writer, surgeon and former prisoner of conscience, Ma Theda, shares her courageous personal journey of resistance with host Michelle Ung Thin.
We are talking about Myanmar's struggle for democracy tonight, but we're taking it from a very particular perspective. This is a Penn Melbourne event. We're in the Wheeler Centre, so we really do need to talk about democracy from the perspective of writers and readers, because writers and readers are both at risk, I think, in Myanmar. And I just wanted to do a little shout out here for Penn. You know, like, news cycles move on, but Penn keeps track of the conflicts which endure. And it's really important that we guard things like the freedom of expression, because they do actually make a difference to civil society. A portion of the takings from tonight's event will be donated to Penn Myanmar as well. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your generosity. So I wanted to do my own introduction to Ma Theda, because we actually have met before. It was 2014, it was Yangon, it was steamy. And I was introduced to Ma Theda. I went round to her the journal office where she was working as an editor, and I was just swept into action. She just said, okay, well, come do this event with us. We're going to read our work, our poems, our literature to people on a train, and we're going to go around Yangon. It's going to be great. It wasn't legal, mind you, but it was fun. And then, you know, Penn Myanmar had meetings, and I was dragged to those, and I was made to meet other writers and poets. And I have to say, this woman is a force of nature. So I know her. I'm delighted to have her here. It's actually been 10 years since we met, 2014 to 2024, and a lot has changed, which is, I guess, the subject of the book. But I wanted to let you introduce yourself a little bit to the audience, and specifically as a writer. You began training as a surgeon, but that was the point in your life when you started writing. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to begin writing?
Well, I think my great grandfather from my mother's side, he's a bookworm. So I inherited, and then after reading a lot, and I so much inspired for this kind of the reading. And then I was so lucky to have my parents. They are from not from the capital city. My father's from Shan State, my mom's from Moon State. So I have been exposed to the other people's plight, especially the poverty of the people in those parts of the country. And I not just in those parts of the country, but also in the jungle, the former capital, there is obvious poverty. And I started thinking seriously about how I can contribute by helping them voicing out what's the reality on the ground, something like that. So I started writing at the age of 16.
It's very much like Chekhov, the doctor who also wrote, yes?
Yeah, at the time I was in my first year of medical school.
Yeah. I have to say, when I was in Myanmar, as an Australian writer, I have to say the conditions that writers dealt with there were a real shock to me. So I wondered if you could describe to us, it sounds so glib, oh, I just started writing short stories, but actually there's an inherent danger in being a writer in Myanmar, and there was a particular danger at that moment in the years leading up to 1988. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, the censorship started in 1962, 4 years before I was born. So you could imagine there was no independent news journalism, news media whatsoever. So all states-owned TV, at that time no TV, the radio station and the current affair news journals. Then the periodicals, even for the periodicals, you know, there is a very heavy censorship. So what we learn through these books is very limited. That's why I was so lucky to have my parents to see vividly from my eyes what's going on in the country. But I know I couldn't write these things, very frankly, in my piece, something like that. We know the limit. So at that time, you know, some books has been banned and some writers already being sent to prisons for their works, something like that. So I know we have freedom to write, but there is no freedom to get published, something like that. Mm. So that's for that reason, you know, it's very much like a lot of our writers are very much entrenched in the self-censorship these days, not just state censorship, in the sense of, you know, some of the topics is becoming a taboo for us. For that reason, we deliberately refrain from touching that. But of course, as creative writers, we use the creativity to expand our freedom. That's why I used to say, as a writer in Myanmar, our creativity never because of the freedom we have. Our creativity is more or less resting on the hunting for the freedom we want to have. So we use a lot of tactics, you know. And the good thing is our readership is very, very good using the imaginative power. So they can read between the lines beyond the text. So we use a lot of metaphors. And even we use some particular names. When we want to mention some characters, we use the name in different forms of the pronunciation, something like that. And the good things of the Burmese literature, the language itself has so many ambiguous vocabularies we can play with. So something like that. But even with that, we still have a potential at least to ban. There are altogether three categories for the writers: blacklist, brown list, and the green list, something like that. So, yeah, I think my name was in brown list just before 1988, but after 1988, my name went to the blacklist.
Right. A rite of passage, if you like. So tell me more about I remember this short story about a crab. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Quite a famous short story. Yeah.
Yeah, in these days, you know, we know the grip of the military at that time, you know, the former military dictator Ne Win, he took the power in 1962 until 1988. So the grip of the military power was so intense. So people, because of the very heavy censorship, very heavy propaganda, very inefficient education, I normally say our society is like the intellectually blind society. For that reason, a lot of people thought, oh, we cannot even against the military power forever, something like that. But just before the 1988 protests, Andawari Uintin, very well-known journalist and a writer, he wrote a small little piece and saying that, oh, the crab, it seems like very strong, that the shell is very sharp, so-and-so, hard, but his eyes, the eyes of the crabs, is the key weak point. If we can hit the eyes, they will deliberately cannot do anything and they're going to die. Something like that. So it's a lot of metaphor encouraging the people thinking about how we can touch the eyes of the crab in terms of the weakness of the military power, something like that.
Small thing and yet so incredibly inspiring. So one of the moments that stood out for me in your prison memoir, which is Prisoner of Conscience, was the way that the poet and political activist Ma Sein Bin greeted you when you were first brought into prison. So Ma Thira, you went from never was on the green list, brown list, and then directly to the black list, and then you were arrested. So maybe actually we should talk about, if you could tell us a little bit how that came about, and then I'll ask you about how you were greeted in prison.
Well, I involved in the protest in 88, and then after that, after the coup in 88 September, the very first military government, and I involved too much with the NLD, National League for Democracy, led by Aung San Suu Kyi. I having working for the information section of NLD. And then after 1989, after her house arrest, I was becoming the activist, underground activist, something like that. So they have been chasing two women. One woman, they got the information, one medical doctor, she's too much involved in against the military, and then another woman's writer. But finally, they found it out, it's only one person. It's not two. At that time, we were against the National Convention. In 1990, there was the general election, and NLD won the majority of seats. But instead of transferring the power to the winning party, military introduced the National Convention to draw the draft of the Constitution. But this National Convention took more than 14 years to finish drawing the draft of the Constitution. It turned out to be the totally undemocratic one. So I really felt this is the kind of the detour. So I was against the National Convention. So that was my crime. Mm-hmm. But the charges is 5 years, 7 years imprisonment for endangering public serenity, contact with 3 years for contact with illegal organization, because they accused me. I read a periodicals published by a parallel government based in Thailand, something like that. You know, my crime is reading the periodicals. But 5 years imprisonment for printing that journal, and the 5 years for distributing it. Indeed, I didn't print. But yeah, this was accusation, so they charged me 20 years imprisonment.
Right. And when you first arrived at Insane Prison in the general cell, you were greeted by the poet and political activist Ma Sein Bin, who yelled at you or shouted at you the first line from her poem, A Single Match. And that line is, "Did you say 20 years?" What an incredible greeting. I have to say, though, there's a real marked use of humor and the driest and most ironic of wit in the poetry and the literature of the activists. So this wit is incredibly effective. Panda is an example of somebody who's incredibly witty, but it's also very, very dangerous. So what is it, do you think, that makes the military so sensitive to humor?
I think we do have a very strong tradition of having tanjat. Tanjat is kind of the rapping style of expressing very beautifully crafted criticisms against anyone who make the wrongdoing, something like that. You know, it's a very long tradition, and we enjoy it during the lunar calendar New Year period. We make this tanjat. So tanjat is more like the dark humor, something like that. That's really effective, and a lot of people felt very encouraged by saying these words, you know. And because of this very heavy censorship, we cannot even direct criticisms against anyone else. So that's why we just trying to say something in this kind of the dark humor or something like that. And then the society appreciate that so much. They understand how much powerful these kind of dark humor. For that reason, that I think the military felt so very allergic to that kind of thing. They know how far this can backlash to them through the understanding of the whole society.
Mm. So it's a very effective way of getting the truth out there and mitigating the threat a little bit. Yeah. I actually, you know, it's funny because you're talking about the dark humor, and it reminds me of another moment when we first met in that office of the journal Pei Tin Tarn. Sorry, my Burmese is terrible. Echoing voice, I think, is the term of it in English. And I remember how you introduced me to your colleagues by name, but also by the prison terms that they had been through. And none of those prison terms were short. It was, this is my editor, he was in prison for 10 years. This is my managing editor, he was in prison for 15 years, 20 years. 25 years. And it was kind of shocking and a little bit, you know, it was dark humor. But, you know, prison, you know, I read in your memoir what the experience was like and the things that you did. It's not, there's only so far that I think humor can go. So can you tell us a little bit about what that experience is like?
Well, I think because of this kind of my senior editors and writers, they all have more or less the imprisonment experience. That's why I was a little bit happy when I was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment. Now I have my chance to write my own prison memoir, something like that. So for that reason, yeah, we more or less the same, you know, trying to express what's going on, not just in the society, but also in this kind of the area. I think this pretty much affecting, I think, even for myself, you know. So I think after my prison memoir has released, and the current younger generation, they all also inspire, so they don't mind to be spending some time in prison. They just try to change the country, whatever the risk is, something like that. So the emotional connection and passing the spirits of revolution from generation to generation is somehow connected to the imprisonments, because it was like very normal. So as you mentioned, you know, you just go into the intellectual society, and you can learn how much of us has been having this similar, more or less a similar experience, either in prisons or having interrogation at the military camp, something like that.
It sort of seemed to be aligned with people who were kind of much more self-censoring, and then people who were prepared to make more of a risk, or who became... Yeah.
In the past, I think before 2021, it was more like that kind of the two extreme groups. One group is very dedicated and ready to do whatever, but one group was in very deep fear. You know, they try not to involve in any part of the political activities. But I think after 2021 failed coup attempt, people... Or most of us are ready to face any risk, because without any political activities, every single one has a similar risk to be treated very, very badly by the military. So they don't make much.
It's a stark choice, though, choose to be a self-censoring writer or choose prison. It's, you know, I don't know what I would choose, to be honest. So... I'm going to go to another part of your memoir where you talk about how it felt to know that people outside, so PEN organized internationally for people to support you and to let you know that you were remembered. And it was a very moving moment in your memoir where you realized that people outside of Myanmar knew who you were. Can you tell us how that felt and what you thought?
Absolutely thrilled. I'm so thrilled. And I never ever heard of PEN before 1990. And when I started learning about the works of the PEN, and I was so inspired and touched, you know, how comes I was no one indeed. I just a short story writer. I was a very quite still young woman. And then I feel so much encouraged by recognizing my work. And that's why I always believed that my imprisonment was not a waste. It was very much taken care of by the PEN Society, Amnesty Society. That means a lot. And I feel I'm very owed to PEN. That's why I'm happy to serve PEN again. And something like that, you know. So it's really, really very touching. after, I think, around about 2-3 years after I was released, some of my friends, they told me at the foreign ministry, they even assigned one civil servant to keep recording and keep all the documents. Because in these days, there was not much the internet developed. Mm. So there was a very strong letter writing campaign from friend centers all over the world. So the foreign ministry receiving a bunch of the letters and the postcards, but I never ever seen them. They just collecting and they destroy.
And you had your own file of yeah. letters. That's a beautiful thing. It brings me though to the idea of, you know, the reader and how the reader kind of exists in Myanmar. Because I remember in 2014 again, you told me at a PEN meeting that parents often censored what their children were reading. And really it was only the 19th century and early 20th century English novelists of all things that they were allowed to read. And it was because they were frightened for their children that they might come across ideas that would put them in danger. So that's such a huge censoring, you know, of information, of culture. It's a kind of mental starvation. Do you think that's shaped attitudes to democracy in Myanmar?
Yeah, it was. That's why people have no idea what their rights are. They really never know about what is human rights. That's why they just trying to accommodate themselves to this very brutal environment. You know, they just try to survive in this censor environment. For that reason, even the parents, they don't care about the others. They just want their kids not to be involved in political activities, mm-hmm. which can make their lives change. So only a few parents can let their kids to do whatever they do. So I feel I was so lucky to have my parents. Otherwise, I will be the same. But after this, the past decades, it has been changed. The relaxations of the censorship in 2012 and beyond, making the society comes to their sense, okay, there are the human rights, they are their rights. That's why after this 2021 Spring Revolution started, people started saying that without our consent, nobody can govern us. So I feel this is the biggest ever achievement in our history mm. when the whole civil society, all the civilians stoop up and say, we the key changer for the country. So without our consent, none of the military guy can govern us.
It is an amazing moment. And, you know, it has been 10 years since we first met. There's been elections in between 2015 and 2020. And while we've spoken about your book, Prisoner of Conscience, which came out in 2015, at a time when maybe you thought, you know, this is never going to happen again, it actually has happened again. So I think, you know, Myanmar was lauded for being a country on the path to democracy, but I want to move to your new book now, which is all about that period between 2010 and 2020, where the path to democracy proved to be something completely different. So can you tell us a little bit more about this idea of the maze and your new book, please?
Indeed, I wrote another book. It's called The Roadmap, and it was published earlier than my present memoir. And the roadmap is all about the history of Myanmar fighting for democracy from 1988 to 2010. So in that book, I used altogether 7 chapters because the earlier military regime, they said we have a 7-step roadmap to democracy. But their meanings of democracy is disciplined democracy, something like that. So I wrote altogether 7 chapters for my book, and the last chapter is called Fork in the Road. So it means that we can at the tip of the fork in the road, and the future road can be varied, something like that. So after the 2010 and during this the quasi civilian quasi military government administration to administration from 10 to 15, 15 to 20. And then people keep asking me, where you are now? You know, I I keep saying we are not yet to reach the destination. That's why for me, I already expected something can be happen, not as we expected, because according to our logic, of course, this is not a promising future if they do the military coup. But the military guides are beyond our logic. We cannot imagine how do they think. So these days, in these decades, from 2010 to 2020, I keep saying we are still at the fork in the road. There might be U-turn, or there might be other way we might, that the, we means that the country might choose. But after 2021, the failed military coup attempt, I started thinking, okay, the international media and community has been saying that we are already being on the road to democracy during these past decades. And then they started saying that we make a U-turn. And then I said, okay, if we say U-turn, we might be reached from point A to point B or point C. And then we made back to point A. That's been the U-turn. But these decades, we never ever reached to any point B or C. We were in a point A because we were in a mess. Under this very undemocratic constitution and some other obstacles, some other structural violence, some other black magic of the army, we were never reached anywhere else, even though the international community thought we reach out to the road to democracy. So I wrote this book, Amazingly, we were walking and marching to the road, to the destination, the democracy. But we got lost, of course, because of the maze. And my argument is there is no exit from this maze. For that reason, shall we just try to tearing down, getting rid of all the walls of the maze? And I try to identify what are the maze for, what are the walls of this maze. So I really encourage my community, my society. It's not just about the eliminating the military dictatorship. There are some other things we are not just building these walls, but somehow we have been reinforcing these walls. Then we cannot get out of, we cannot get back to the road to democracy. So then I think instead of finding the aces from this amazing maze, shall we just tearing down the walls of the maze and get back to the road to democracy?
Do you think it's an irony, in a way, that this coup beginning, the protests against it to begin with were about reinstating the elected government. But really, it's become a revolution. So it's a kind of movement through, a thinking through. Is that part of what you think has happened?
Yes, of course. The real challenge for us in this past decade to administration is the 2008 Constitution. For that reason, somehow people said, okay, it's good to have this coup. Otherwise, under the title of reconciliation, it was never being a real true reconciliation between the civilians and the military people. But because of this trap, because of this maze, we just come along and we just enjoying some small little bit of the space. But we thought it's a democracy, something like that. But now the good thing is people understand what's the barriers, what's the walls, and then started tearing down all the walls. So the positive side effect of the outcomes from the coup is people are now more understanding about what they were and what they're supposed to do. Something like that. So somehow it's good enough to making themselves how much they are needed, and they are the key players to make a real change for the country.
We can't really leave this discussion without asking what you know of Aung San Suu Kyi, what is happening, what is her state of welfare, and what is her role now in this kind of new movement as a leader?
Well, I think she, right now, we really don't know the whereabout of her. She was in prison since 2022. Very difficult situation for the 79 years old lady, and very terrible situation in the prisons in Naypyidaw. And it was supposed to, she was relocated to small little house somewhere in Naypyidaw in order to let her meet with some other international dignitaries, including from China and Thailand, something like that. But she resisted to cooperate with the military to have this chance because, you know, she was arrested at the very beginning, so she couldn't know much about what's going on right now. That's why she tried not to make any comments, something like that, especially on the armed revolution, you know. Their trick bug is they try to make her involved in saying that I disagree with the armed resistance, something like that. So, but she refrained from it. And I think, I might say she was trained as a gentleman in UK throughout her earlier days. For that reason, she really hoping that she has a ability to convince the military to get change. So that's why under the title of reconciliation, she did a lot of effort to make the better relationship, but indeed it was not. The series of incidents, I can say, that's why I wrote this a little bit thick book. Otherwise, you know, I can just write a small little piece to say the challenge. But it was series of the incidents, how much she herself and the commander-in-chief having so much disagreement and the subtle but obvious tension and conflict for so many incidences and the concepts. At the same time, I think they're still really afraid of her. You know, her way of handling things was not very okay to our eyes, especially on the issues of the Rohingya and the Rakhine incident. But after some times, because of these, so many information has been disclosed. Right now, we know, I can say the current commander-in-chief, he has a big fear of putting into the ICC trial. So after some development of the ICJ trial, he was thinking Aung San Suu Kyi and NLD might disclose all the hidden wrongdoing of his own and the military at some point and then move to another trial. So his fear of putting into the ICJ and ICC is part of the reasons for the coup.
So his personal fear of being held accountable.
Yeah, because, you know, he turned out 60 at the 60 years of age in 2015, and then he requested Aung San Suu Kyi and the president, NLD presidents, to give him another 5 years, the extensions of the term, but they denied. But according to this very undemocratic constitution, he can unilaterally extend his term. So commander-in-chief recommended himself for another 5 years term and saying that I couldn't find any suitable persons. So his another extensions will be due in 2021. For that reason, he has a big fear. If he has no power, he won't make himself secure. So that's for that reason, I think, yeah, he truly needs to hold the power to keep his security beyond.
To be safe.
Why he make this coup.
Yeah. From the outside, the situation in Myanmar, it looks really desperate, I have to say. The armed conflicts, the bombings that we hear about, the extrajudicial killings, you know, tens of thousands of people, most recently conscription of young men fleeing their jobs, fleeing the country. It looks like the people are suffering very, very deeply for democracy. So what is your feeling for the future? Do you feel hopeful?
Yes, I do. Because this is the moment of the we having more or less more strategic unity among the different groups of people, different identity. We do have more than around about 100 different groups, the different identities. So it was not very united. Right now, of course, we still have some kind of the dispute and the argument among these different identities, but to against the military, they all are strategically united. So that's a very good moment. And on the other hand, I think the situation on the ground is the military fight every single battles on the ground to the people defense forces and ethnic armed forces. For that reason, they use the airstrikes. You know, up to now, it's been almost 20,000 airstrikes in this 3 years' time. You know, they use a lot of the airstrikes, arsons, and they even killed people burning alive. That's kind of things going on. But the stubborn resistance from the ground is still going on. And most of the border area has been under the hands of the ethnic armed forces and the people defense forces already. So the only border trade incomes is now cannot control by the military right now. So I think the two things, one thing is the armed fightings, they are failing. And on the other hand, because of the conscription law, a lot of the workforces has run out from the country or from their workforce. So the economic failing is going on. Countries is still heading to the phase state deliberately designed by the military. And since he has no capacity of any kind of the decent governance, so the chaos on the ground is so high and intense right now. But ridiculously, they are also fighting each other in the high-ranking military officers level. Something like that. So the whole picture sounds pretty much chaotic, but more on their side, more on the military side. So I think truly they cannot control the power anymore because the highest rate of defection is going on, and they also lie to us, the population of the combatants. So for that reason, they run out of their human resources and they establish this conscription law. So the way they handle for their own institution is like the self-sabotage. So for that reason, I think the military institution itself is very much not in control. It's a total disarray right now.
It seems like huge destruction.
Yeah.
All round to kind of get these tiny green shoots of democracy, such a valued thing to kind of start to grow. Mathida, I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Thank you. You've been listening to Michelle Ungteng in conversation with Mathida. It was recorded on Thursday, the 6th of June, 2024, at the Wheeler Centre. The event was presented in partnership with Penn Melbourne and supported by RMIT Culture. The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news, and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.